Thank
Great.
you.
Okay. Elizabeth Warren had a really fascinating anecdote that she told us, and I think I remember you telling me about it some years ago yourself. But it goes to the issue of how the mortgage market had changed so dramatically and in new ways that even people who are very knowledgeable about mortgages found themselves sort of struggling to understand all the ways it was morphing. And she talked about an incident that happened at Harvard Business School, where a group of people were all in a room, and she remembered it only sort of hazily, but it was such a colorful story that we were hoping you would remember it as well. There were a group of people, housing experts, in a room. It was at Harvard Business School, and the question was asked, people were asked to say what kind of loans they had. And it was something where people had to stand, everyone stood up, sit down if you know, if you have fixed rate, if you have an adjustable rate. Does this ring a bell to
Vaguely
you?
remember, yes.
Do you know where it was?
It was at the Harvard Business School, and it was a convening by the Joint Center, I believe. Don't remember the date.
So, but sometime probably like in, do you think it was like in 2005 or 2006?
Eric Belsky would know the answer to that
Okay,
question.
all
I am
right.
speaking with Eric tomorrow. I could ask him.
Oh, that'd be great.
So send me an email, and I'll see with that specific question. I'll see if I can get an answer to that.
Okay. Do you remember how it worked? She explained to us that it was something that, a series of questions were posed to the group, and you had to sit down if you knew the answer to the question. If you didn't know the answer to the question, I think that's how it worked.
Just tell us what
I
you
don't
remember
remember.
about it.
Yes.
Oh, no, I don't remember much at all. It sounds like Elizabeth has a much more distinct memory than I do about it. I do remember we had that convening at the Harvard Business School, and I do remember there was a question, probably the only one that was dramatically in my mind was over the fixed-rate mortgage, which everybody had.
Yes, everyone in there had a fixed rate mortgage. So
Right.
so of the group of people who were experts looking at this, everyone themselves had a fixed rate mortgage.
If they had a mortgage at all.
Okay. So part of what you have is people who are even very sensitive to these issues are not being yet personally affected.
Correct.
Right. When did you first start to hear about some of the new mortgages coming along?
Well, you may not be aware of this, but in 2005, I wrote a paper, or I started doing presentations, started writing a paper. The paper was completed in 2006. The paper extended work that Professor Andrei Pavlov, Pavlov, and I had done, extended a model to apply to the United States, a model, an empirical work that we had done for the real estate crises in Asia. So we had a model, which is generic, of a race to the bottom, and we had published, I believe in 2006, a paper that we had written in 2003 or 4 in Real Estate Economics, and I can get you the site for that, which is the inevitability of the inevitability of risk, the inevitability of underpricing of risk in a market setting, which made the point that in a model where short-run fees were generated, the actors, agents, would move to generate short-term fees and change even the structure so that short-term fees would be generated, extent there was room to do so, at the expense of long-run risk.
Yes.
And they would do so if their horizon, if some of the actors, not all, but if some of the actors had a short-term horizon. And we defined that in the paper. So if they did, if they were short-term maximizers, not all, some, the result would be that the entire system eventually would transform itself, would become one where everyone was a short-term maximizer or out of the system entirely.
Yes.
That there was inevitability to this. And I will get you, there are two or three papers, but I will get you the key ones. One was published in, as I said, RE Real Estate Economics, the other in Journal of Real Estate Finance and Economics. And it was based off, and we tested it empirically, and specifically we tested, by the way, this work was based on previous work that I did in 19... 19- 98, with Professor Richard Herring of the Wharton School, looked at banking booms and real estate crashes, real estate busts, banking booms and real estate busts, and how they empirically often go together, and made the point that it is not by accident, that it's deeply related the two, simply because banks use comparables, appraisals, to underwrite real estate, and that optimists tend to win in the real estate deals, transactions, and there is no short selling, very little short selling in individual transactions and prices on commercial and the also on the residential side. So that if financing is available, then if there are booms, who knows what they do, to leave that aside for a moment, but if there are booms, if there's financing available, the optimists will win and will be financed. That's why, you know, in finance, you have both optimists and pessimists. The optimists are balanced by the short sellers. That's one way. And then, of course, if the optimists, in fact, are overwhelming, they will be put out of business because they'll go bankrupt. But in this case, they don't, because the banks go fund them until the banks get bankrupt. Okay, so that was the original work. Then Andre and I did this mathematically and then set up a test. And the test, empiric test, we tried on 30, 40 crises worldwide, and we found that you could predict the extent of the crisis after the event that the stochastic event which set off the crisis after a boom, you could predict the depth of the price decline in real estate, and we have various indices of price decline, as a function of credit availability prior to the crisis.
Uh-huh.
Specifically, we looked at, and we call this the Pavlov-Wachter indicator, and in fact, I gave a talk in 2007, the summer, August 2007, at Jackson Hole, right after Chairman Bernanke, and spoke about this research, and it was cited by others referring to Asia because we were using the Asia data. So looking at the risk premium and the correlation between the lending risk premium, the reduction in the lending risk premium, and asset price inflation, all else equal, all other factors in asset price controlled for. And if there is a correlation prior to the crash between the basically cost of debt or the risk-adjusted cost of debt, as shown in the risk premium, then indeed the price decline is significantly greater after the crisis. And we did this in various ways. So that paper has gotten much attention. It's on SSRN. We then saw in 2002-2003 the same thing is happening in the U.S.
It is
happening in the U.S. But we didn't know that it was happening in the U.S. Which we said we start working on it. But 2004-2005, we believed strongly that the risk premium was declining. We weren't able to get the data, and that is a very important part of this entire history. We could not get the data. One still can not get the data. The data on loan to value, for example, because you have to hold constant the terms of the, you can't just look at the price, you have to look at the terms.
Uh-huh.
It's very difficult to track because of the heterogeneity of the loans. It is extremely difficult to set up an index, and I could send you additional work by other co-authors and myself on the struggle to do this with loan performance data, which is the only data in town. But real time, very difficult to track this. In any case, backing up, what we could track was anecdotes, and we could track the very fact that 2003-2004 in industry inside mortgage loans, the toxic loans, the non-traditional loans, market share was dramatically increasing.
Right.
That we could see.
Right.
How much the loan-to-value ratio was increasing, how much the Alt-A was increasing, what was the correlation between the low doc loans and LTV, that we could not see without a significant delay.
Right.
And that's key because, in fact, that sets up the pricing of credit.
Uh-huh.
Now, in recent work with Adam Levitan, we have tracked, in retrospect, very difficult, CMBS pricing. And we have shown that CMBS pricing from 2002 to 2008 collapsed. That is, the price of risk declined significantly. uh-huh. which is highly correlated to commercial real estate prices increasing. Now, that you know very well that there's also, there's not only a housing crisis, there's also a commercial real estate crisis.
Uh-huh.
The difference is foreclosure, which is a social problem in housing, and there, and also, of course, housing is three times the size of commercial, or four times, so it makes an altogether different impact on the banking sector and on the overall economy. But back to the situation, we still cannot track RMBS.
Right.
Which, of course, how can you measure risk if you can't measure pricing of what everyone else is pricing at? So, and also the expansion of debt. How, you don't know this. And so that's basically the heterogeneity. That's why it couldn't be priced. So I did some work with a lot of people on that. Now, but I did, we did see the indicator of the increase in the non-standard mortgages, the negative amortization mortgages, the option arm mortgages, the interest-only mortgages. Market share took off, basically didn't exist prior, or very small, almost immeasurably small, but we could measure that, and that did start dramatically increasing in 2003, in 2004. So that's when we wrote our paper applying these theories to the United States.
Right.
When you presented your
paper... We gave that paper, by the way, in January 2007 in the American Real Estate and Urban Economics, which is part of the American ASSA meetings,
uh-huh.
in January of 2007. And we said this is a bubble. It's a bubble because it's credit-induced, and the credit cannot be maintained. These credit standards cannot be maintained because they are reliant, they're non-sustainable credit, they're reliant on risk decreasing when risk, the book of business, the risk is increasing.
Right.
Can I ask you a question about the presentation of the paper in 2007? What kind of, I mean, you're talking to two writers who aren't as deeply familiar with all the data. So just, this is a layman's question, but what kind of reaction did you get to the paper?
It was universally panned.
Oh, okay.
Our discussant was an economist from the Mortgage Bankers of America, and he said this is absurd.
And what did they base it on, their criticism?
Just, by the way, had a meeting, if I may, probably it's private, so I'll leave it aside, but a meeting of economists with high-level government officials where they're still saying it. And that is that private sector investors would not take risk that wasn't priced appropriately. They simply would not do it.
They would be too intelligent to do it?
You mean
exactly.
like
that's what they thought.
Appropriately priced. And the risk is appropriately priced. Private sector will price risk appropriately. No evidence to that, but based on philosophy, that will be the case. Now, of course, from our position, from our model, the answer is no, because it's unknown. Two, of course, because of the rating agencies giving it an imprimatur, so that's a moral hazard. And three, no one could know the entire book of business. You could only have signs of what was going on, and since we had a model of there would be a race to the bottom for market share, and everyone would turn to short-term maximizers, we looked for the anecdotal evidence.
They said you looked for anecdotal evidence.
No, I mean, we did. I mean, we did. The evidence
yeah,
of the increase
right.
in market share. Now,
right.
when we did get full evidence,
uh-huh.
which we did have in 2000, so by 2006, we did have evidence. Was more than anecdotal. It wasn't as, we didn't have all the terms, because as I said, very difficult to value study, but we just looked at market share by geography of non-traditional mortgages
right.
over time.
Right.
And we used used the econometrics that are subject, that are instrumental variables to protect against endogeneity. The paper is actually published now. It took 3 years to publish it because of resistance.
Why did it take that? What happened?
The paper is currently published in the premier journal in real estate. There is, even to this date, tremendous resistance. So if I may say so,
yeah.
I put on a conference, a wonderful conference I joined in that was convened by the Philadelphia Federal Reserve. Bank, and there will be a book, and there are a number of very excellent articles in this book, Penn Press will be putting it out this spring, a number of excellent articles which you might want to look at, which I can send to you. One of the very interesting ones is by Paul Willen and others, saying economists did not know and, moreover, could not know.
And you think that's baloney?
Yes.
So you just mentioned something that, of course, is very intriguing, and that is you wrote a paper, you had evidence, you did the data, you ran the data, and you said, this is what's going to happen, it happened. And if I heard you right, you said you just were just in a meeting with very high-level federal officials, and they're still dubious?
Yes.
So tell me more about
not
this.
Not the federal officials. I'm not characterizing their views. They were listening mode. The real estate economists.
The real estate economists.
So what can you just describe what setting this was?
No, this is a little makes me a little bit uncomfortable. Real estate economists do what they do extremely well.
Okay.
So let me back up. I have extremely good colleagues whose models are excellent. The problem, I believe, is the data simply are not there sufficiently for the models to be tested. We did the best we could, but it's just one study. You would need tens of such studies. You would need an army of researchers, because we're going against the underpinnings, which is that markets are efficient. Now, I, too, believe markets are efficient in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I don't mean here to be panning my fellow economists, because they do what they do extremely well, and they are, in the long run, very good judges of work. So, and I appreciate the reception the paper is getting now from those who are reading it now. Obviously, it'll take some time. But my work is just, you know, it's a sideshow in a sense. The more important question is having the data so that good analysts could track this and model this over time, and it did not exist.
Can I just follow
and
on?
It does not exist.
Can I just follow on? Isn't this area going to be one of the hottest areas that's going to be studied going forward now?
I don't think so necessarily.
And tell me why.
There's a gap. There a finance. Empirical finance researchers, empirical real estate researchers don't necessarily speak to each other. There are two separate fields. The institutional behavioral game theoretic work is yet a third field. And understanding that this pricing collapse, the basic understanding of where and how this pricing collapse came about, there is no consensus yet. And the understanding that I have, which I do believe actually is accurate, and I do believe actually the forensic folks who are working, such as yourselves, are also quite clearly, and industry also quite clearly is coming to this point. But that doesn't mean the models are out there. That could happen 10 years from now, or not at all.
Do you also think, Professor Wachter, that everyone was trained in a certain way of thinking, and their beliefs are so great that they're not scientific, they're almost religious?
I wouldn't say it that way. What I would say is, really I wouldn't say it that way, what I would say is that empirical economists, including empirical real estate economists, work with the data they have. The data were non-existent. The data that we were able to use was we stretched to use the data that we did use, and it's not sufficient to support hundreds of research and really that need to be done. And in order to come, we need an army of people, just in the same way as we track inflation, we need to track, from my perspective, asset bubbles. And the reason we need to is because they're not self-resolving without major collapses. Now we're getting back to debates that, for example, Chairman Bernanke has weighed in on this. He wrote a paper, I believe, in 2004 on this. And he said, as an academic, I believed that asset bubbles were self-resolving. But now my new view, and this is before, he was still an academic, he was saying academic previously, I believe, but my new view is that they're not necessarily and can bring the entire economy down. So this is an open area, but whether this open area actually gets translated into research and ongoing research, the call for that is not out there.
Interesting.
I will call for it, but the call for that is not generally out there.
So what's going to be the interest, just to sort of pull the sheet over the cadaver here and pretend nobody died?
No, I think it's quite the contrary. What the answer is, the body died, and therefore we have a whole new risk scenario, which we will going forward be putting into our into our measures of risk, and therefore it happened the way you would expect it. It was learned from the past, and now we will have updated measures. We will understand the risk, because we will, instead of going, no, prices can't fall at all, yes, prices can fall 40%. But the problem from that, from my perspective, is, of course, prices could fall 40%. They had just fallen 40, 50, 60% in Japan 5 years before the crisis. So, of course, they said that now that, but... And the problem is, nothing new with me. The problem is the pro-cyclicality of measurements of risk. So now we will have in our systems a very high risk measure, because we just come through this episode. And that's in part, of course, banks are not making these loans, correct?
Yes.
Securitization has not yet started up, correct? And Basel is correctly so asking for more capital, correct? Mm-hmm. But and it will build up over time. So the capital requirements are low now, but they'll build up over time. But all of that said, this is exactly, you know, this is not the time to build up capital, correct? Now is the time. We should have built up capital before, but we haven't really solved the pro-cyclicality. Nonetheless, those viewing it from 60,000 feet can say, well, we have had an episode that is going to change our measures of risk going forward. All is well.
That would be the optimistic view again, correct?
Well, I think it's absolutely a problem, and the risk, and of course everyone would agree that it's going to come from a different direction. I think next time we're going to have an interest rate shock, and because we have very low interest rates. And again, tracking that with real estate prices, because real estate is 50% of the assets of the world. Real estate is higher percentage of the assets of households, and therefore translates into household balance sheets in a way that no other asset does, individual households, and increases the risk exposure of individual households and the banking sector. But my point is that tracking real estate pricing is a new, it's a new concept even. And part of the reason for that is that real estate, especially housing, has been disconnected from capital markets historically. And it's only in the last decades that housing has been connected to capital markets. So I think that, unfortunately, we may need a few more crises to point to the urgent need to analyze how housing prices are connected to global capital shifts of pricing. Because this connection is only since, in the most developed world, since 1980, 1990. Before that, real estate housing was segmented off in a separate allocated funding to the banking system. And in addition to that, the... So mortgages were allocated capital. Now, worldwide, mortgages are connected to capital markets. Very new. And I guess the other point that I did want to make, throughout much of the world, as you're quite well aware, mortgages are connected to capital markets through short-term financing. These mortgages are variable rate mortgages. Households are exposed to interest rate risk. That's been fine over the last 20 years as these markets have grown dramatically, and I mean dramatically. 5-6% a year, even before 2000 when they really took off. But in any case, in this period, 1980 to 2000 to date, interest rates have fallen globally. Mm-hmm. So there hasn't been an interest rate shock mechanism to take down housing prices. That could very well happen next. Because again, this connection is now there, But analyzing this connection is not the focus of anyone or any large group.
Generally speaking, the economists that you're speaking to now, do they think that this is all over now?
Oh, absolutely.
What do you think?
Yes, I actually do think so. I think, of course, the banking sector, and we could have a double dip, but, you know, that's a whole other story. And, you know, are real estate prices stabilizing? I don't know if this is the moment to proffer my views on that. That's a whole other question. But the crisis is, for most people's view, over.
Can I just clarify, because the mandate for the Federal Crisis Inquiry Commission is to look at both the financial crisis and the economic crisis, or the linkage thereof. So when you say it's over, you mean the precipitating event, the financial crisis. Is that what you mean?
Yes, exactly. Not the economic crisis.
Correct.
The economic crisis goes on.
Correct.
But the economic crisis, the recession is over. We're obviously on very shaky grounds. The recession is over, but our growth rate 1.6%. Income actually declined recently, so, you know, obviously we're still in a very shaky period, but the financial crisis is over.
One of the things that we've done in the last month is we went out and did field hearings in different parts of the country, and we heard some very alarming things there. That, for example, in the state of Nevada, 70% of the homes are underwater now. 50% of the mortgages in South Florida, they think, were based on mortgage fraud. And in a lot of these states, the tax base is so badly damaged that the ripple effect will continue
this
for
will
years
take
ahead.
Years. This will take years, best case, to work our way out of it, as it did in Japan. Now, when I say the financial crisis is over, I mean the liquidity crisis is over. We could have another crisis. I can't assure that we won't. If in fact unemployment has a double dip, there are all sorts of scenarios you can put out there. We're not out of the woods yet, but the severe liquidity crisis is over, and that's the view of most people. And I'm not even characterizing myself. I'm saying that is what most economists would say.
When you look at when you yourself observe some of the ripple effects on the economy, is there anything that is unique to this meltdown that you think we still haven't run completely through and that worries you?
Well, absolutely. What's absolutely different about this meltdown is it's based on private label securitization, which we, by the very nature of the private label securitization, was not regulated, was not standardized, was not controlled. That was just the point. The controls were off in this race to the bottom. Therefore, crises such as we have today, the documentation of who actually owns the loans is going to happen. This is going to be part of the resolution because none of this is tracked carefully. There wasn't, or in some cases, some banks, I'm sure, did do a very careful job, but there wasn't external oversight into the documentation.
So you're saying that we haven't seen the transparency part of what we want to be the resolution, and you think there's more murkiness ahead?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, this transparency issue is really the key to the entire meltdown and to the lack of controls, because it's in a non-transparent capital transaction setting that one, the risk can grow, and without the knowledge of what else is in the book of business, where you can have pricing that's based on models as opposed to actual transactions. And through 2006, that's what was happening until, in fact, a short market was developed by Goldman Sachs' actions and others, where they developed CDOs for the purpose of short selling, because they're, although some of my colleagues may not have seen the price decline is inevitable, many institutional players on Wall Street did see the decline is inevitable. And they took steps.
When did you yourself really come to understand the whole CDO, CDS world?
In 2006, well, I didn't understand the CDO, but in 2006 it did appear to me about the same time as some institutional players saw it as well, that the decline was inevitable. And part of that is there were some excellent papers that were being written at that time. You know, I regarded mine as one of them. But on the other side, and one of these, this article, the chapter that's going to be booked, will point you to them, which were trying to make the case that prices were not in a bubble over fundamentals, but in fact were justified by fundamentals. And the assumptions that needed to be made to take that position were so extreme and unrealistic that, to me, they made the case even though they were attempting to make the opposite case. So that just lays it out there that if you have information and you do carefully analyze it. Now, the paper that I'm referring to was written using data up through 2004. It did not use data in 2005, but I extrapolated what happened to prices after the paper that was written in 2004 just barely made an argument that fundamentals were still in line. And then in 2005, prices continued to increase in a time, far more than income, by the way, in a time when interest rates were rising. And that should, of course, weigh in the other direction. So there was no explanation from a market rational perspective for the price rise in 2006. And at that point, I knew that there was a significant bubble. What I did not know was the extent of the shadow banking financing. I did not know the extent of the CDO growth at this period in time. Nobody knew that.
Right.
Nobody could know. And that is still a real issue.
And is that market, in your mind, in a lull phase, or is it going to ramp back up, or what do you think?
I believe all these securitization markets will ramp back up.
Okay. Even with Dodd-Frank, I mean, it obviously will take years to implement that, but...
Yes, I believe so. Just look at international experience. There are equivalent covered bond markets in other countries like Spain, for example, where they had equivalent, or not equal, but they had securitization market failures. They have, in the Spanish economy, 20% unemployment right now. They had a boom and bust, which was in part funded by the growth of the cajas, which were funded by securities, which are called seguros, which, in fact, were very hard to track, were assumed perhaps to be government guaranteed and therefore moral hazard. So too big to fail, securitization from large banks, perhaps we'll have that.
You had mentioned in 2007 when you delivered your paper in Jackson Hole that Bernanke was there right before you, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I were Ben Bernanke, I think I would love to have you come and give a presentation now. Do you know if the Fed, or can you say if the Fed has been interested in this whole line?
Well, I am giving a paper at the FDIC-FRB conference on October 25th.
And where will that be?
In Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'm giving a presentation, I shouldn't say a paper.
So you imagine that the Fed knows about this paper, has looked at it?
Well, I think it's great, there's a great deal of skepticism, and why not? A great deal of skepticism about it. There's a huge, the traditional view, and I understand it, and I, you know, stepping aside and not looking at my work in particular, but just seeing the big picture, how can you ever predict asset bubbles? You know, how can this be done? It's impossible. Asset bubbles, by their very nature, they're irrational. How can they be predicted? Anything, sunspots could cause them. Now, that is the language, and that's the language, that's the thinking, that I believe one ought to try, and one ought to look for particular correlations between credit pricing and asset pricing, all else equal, is perhaps I'm an outlier, because in fact, if you look at, I guess part of the way one can frame this is, if you look at history, there have been asset bubbles throughout time, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Many asset bubbles in many different fields, and so most economists would say, that's irrational exuberance. Can't possibly model irrational exuberance. So from my perspective, there's a lot of truth to that. But in housing, where the financing comes from banks and mortgages. It's not just people buying tulips, it's people being financed to purchase. In fact, they couldn't do it without financing. One should look to the financing, particularly because the tail risk is owned by the American taxpayer.
That's
banking
a really good point.
Ultimately, tail risk is owned by the taxpayer.
If, in fact, at
the end of the day, the conclusion is we cannot track asset bubbles in housing, that we are going to have crises where we have 1 in 4 mortgages underwater every 10 years or so, then perhaps we have to rethink our housing finance system and the connection to capital markets. Because I don't think these crises are, in fact, sustainable in terms of the next step when a crisis like this happens, which is that, as I just said, the taxpayer owns the tail risk, steps in, bails out, and as much as, you know, we might say, no, we'll never do that again, we won't bail out again, we'll never do that again, when there is a foreclosure crisis that brings the economy to its knees, we will bail out. So I do believe that if, in fact, we cannot predict, and possibly I'm wrong, and we cannot analyze and stop it, then we need a different set of go-slow stops. We need controls. We can't do this every 10 years.
You had also mentioned the commercial market and the crisis there, which is somewhat less observable. Can you expand on that a little bit? What you see there, you know, how long that's taking to spool out?
Well, I think that's going to be much less difficult to pull out of because, in fact, the problem on the housing side is once you have foreclosure, you have people who are put out of their homes. That adds to the inventory, which leads to a potentially downward spiral. Whereas in the commercial side, you don't have the foreclosure process leading to people being put out of their homes because it's rented. Everything is rented practically in this setting. So rather what happens is other owners take over, but the renting process continues. The renters continue to pay their rent to a different owner after the commercial real estate has gone into after foreclosure has occurred. So it's socially an entirely different phenomenon, and the taxpayer owns that risk on some level, but the nature of the meltdown is extremely different, which is why it seems to me that in the same way we have deposit insurance in banks for depositors those who can take extreme risk, we need to especially carve out what happens in the housing sector. There has to be controls and risk monitoring in the housing sector because the American taxpayer, just like they'll bail out the banks, they'll bail out the depositors, they will bail out the homeowners. And the reason we haven't seen this historically, except back in the Depression, which we did, is because we have been in a time of decreasing interest rates. And in a time prior to the decreasing interest rates, that is in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, we were in a period where housing was disconnected from the financial system.
So do you think the interest rate picture was part of the causal nature of this crisis?
No, I do not directly. So on that, I agree with Chairman Bernanke and Chairman Greenspan. Indirectly, I do believe there's a role here because prices started increasing in 2000. Actually, they even started increasing in the late 1990s. But coming out of the recession of 2000-2001, we actually had interest rates decreasing, highly unusual. It was really one of the first times we've seen that. And that helped fuel a demand for housing and real estate in general. And prices started increasing. They had been increasing, as I said, but they continued to increase 2001, 2002, 2003. Thus, that fed expectations of further price rises. But once again, and homes transacted. But at that point, what happened in 2003 was two things. One, 2003 interest rates stopped falling. 2003, 2004 interest rates stopped falling. So it doesn't explain the price rise that continued 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006. So that interest rate could decline, could explain through 2003, but doesn't explain after 2003. First.
Mm-hmm. What do you think might have been going on in the rest of the in our economy that was unrelated to that might have been a factor?
Well, what explained the price rise after 2003 was the change in credit conditions. That basically was a decline in risk-adjusted interest rates. So the cost of capital for housing declined. And in addition, the cost was backloaded. So the effective cost of mortgages short run declined dramatically, which of course is effectively a decrease in interest rates.
And you've also talked about the increasing prevalence of non-traditional mortgages.
So effectively a decrease in mortgage payments.
Yes.
Which from the perspective of the house buyer is like an interest rate decrease.
But a temporary one.
But a very temporary one that is inevitably going to rebound and boomerang.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why that won't happen again. And the reason why I say there's no reason why that won't happen again is it has happened internationally.
Uh-huh.
It has happened in other countries recently. And there's it's happened in Spain. It's happened in Ireland. It happened in the UK. Now, I'm not totally familiar with the controls that the UK is putting in place. But I know that, among other things, they have consolidated their regulation. The FSA has been consolidated into the Bank of England. They are making significant changes.
One of the things that's been really interesting as we've conducted the hearings, and Alexis and I have only been here, both of us, just a few months as we went into the writing phase, so we haven't been here for this whole, year and a half ramp up to the production of the report. We're reading things and, looking back and reading what was done in the past. But it's really fascinating how many people, industry leaders and regulators, who have told us that there were no warnings, that they were completely blindsided by this. Do you know of any warnings that there were major credit, major problems looming ahead because of rising prices and the advent of new mortgages?
Many insiders were totally aware of the crisis to come.
I'm sorry, say that again?
I think many insiders were totally aware of the crisis to come. I think Goldman Sachs in 2006 was aware of the crisis to come and took steps to protect the firm.
But nobody really felt like they wanted to warn the American people?
Oh, quite the contrary. I think that if you read the newspapers in 2006, you will see a number of articles about the housing boom.
Yes.
And that issues of, is this sustainable?
Right.
I certainly was being quoted at that time, and Rubini was quoted, John Paulson was quoted. These people were not, they were short sellers. Paulson was a short seller, but he wasn't hiding the fact that he was a short seller.
Why is it that you think that all these people think they can come and testify and say that they didn't know then?
Well, some didn't.
Some didn't testify or some didn't know?
No, I'm sorry, some did not know.
Some did not know.
I think there was a disconnect between the higher level managers, the CEOs, and the managers of the mortgage book of business, which was two or three levels beneath. And I think the managers of the mortgage book of business, who were far down the chain of command, often did know that they were being asked. And by the way, I think you can look in your own testimony, the FCIC testimony, look at the emails back and forth from such groups like Countrywide,
uh-huh,
to see the understanding on the ground, in the field. Push it out now because we don't have much more time.
Right.
Did people raise this specifically with the Fed, saying you really need to do something to regulate this because it's going to hurt a lot of people?
Well, of course, yes, of course. And I'm going to block it. The wonderful member of the Fed,
Ned Gramlich.
Ned Gramlich. And Ned and I did talk, actually, as well. Yes, and Ned and I actually even talked about what could be done. And we even played with some possibly regulating some states or offering to have some states go into it more transparent, and obviously states did adopt regulations. By the way, when I was at the when I was at HUD, mm-hmm. As Assistant Secretary, mm-hmm. we did see that predatory lending was a problem for the individual borrowers.
Yes.
And we in Treasury put together a report. We didn't see it as a systemic problem because in 1998, when we were writing this, 1999, 2000, it wasn't a systemic problem yet.
Yes.
But we did certainly see it as a absolute problem for the borrowers who were being exposed to this increased risk through stripping of equity from their homes, and that this was indeed leading to a default crisis, which then happened in 2000. We actually had an early warning default crisis. Some parts of the country where subprime lending was a very large percentage of the book of business,
uh-huh.
and the 2000 recession hit, they had a severe default and foreclosure crisis. That happened to Philadelphia, for
right.
example.
Right.
And after that, for a period from, I believe, 2001 perhaps, for that year, 2002 perhaps, actually subprime loans decreased, the origination decreased. But then they expanded tremendously across the country, particularly in areas where prices were high. But then, of course, what happened was, to in our study, this is a study by Pavlos and Wachter, the expansion of non-traditional option arms, subprime lending, which was teaser rates usually, adjustable rate, teaser rate, in addition to adjustable teaser rate, the expansion fueled the lending and increased the pricing exactly in these markets where subprime increased its market share.
Why didn't the Fed do something to stop this?
Well, as you probably know, Ned Gramlich did speak to Greenspan, and there was, I don't know the nature of those conversations, but there's been a number of people who've written on that.
Well, I guess your own experience presenting a paper that was running counter to conventional thinking would have certainly chilled conversation for those who wanted to bring up an alternative point of view.
I don't think so, actually. I actually think that this is in deep belief. Maybe for some it's different, but...
You think it's deep belief on their part?
I just was on a radio show this morning, National Public Radio, where Mary called in and said, you know, she was being forced to make these liar loans and, you know, do all these things, and still is, non-documenting, and once she just, you know, went and said she can't do it anymore and this is wrong, she was fired. Now she's back there doing it again because she needs her job. Now, this is Mary, unknown person calling.
Mary, so unknown person.
Very factual.
I know. I want to hear about Alan, known person.
So we don't know,
and Ben,
right?
And Ben,
know,
other known person. Tell us about Alan and Ben.
Yeah, but in your documentation of the FCIC, there are a number of, I'm sure, these people who are saying, yes, that they were chilled on the ground and not calling attention to what was happening. But back to, you know, economists actually believe that markets were working. And they still do, and they're my colleagues, and many of them are extremely bright, and they certainly are honorable.
Can I ask you about the GSEs?
Just a second. This is something that I'm finding really fascinating, because they persist in this belief even with the evidence in front of them.
Yes.
They won't see the evidence of their own eyes.
No.
How can this be rational?
You might want to speak to Sarah Wartell,
uh-huh.
The Center for American Progress, because I had a meeting where I attempted actually to bring together economists of all stripes, because there are some economists, obviously I am one of them, who look to the data. The conversation was really eye-opening, and she could characterize it for you perhaps better than I can.
Okay.
So this was a dinner after the... So, you know, we've had these gatherings, these convenings at Elizabeth mentioned. So we had one at Harvard 2 years ago. We had one at Harvard very recently. We had one at the Philadelphia Fed of economists. And what I attempted to do in the convening at the Philadelphia Fed in May of 2010, May 14th in 2010, was to bring together economists who are believe deeply in the workings of the efficient market, and as well as some empiricists who, such as myself, who were looking to the data and finding otherwise. That dialogue in the dinner afterwards was quite eye-opening, and you might, and it seems like Sarah, who was there, not an economist herself, but just listening, was rather took things down, and I didn't. So she has some quotes which you might find interesting.
Okay. Well, I guess the belief is that markets will eventually
And by the
be
way, I will send you this paper. This paper will be very useful for your thinking.
No, that sounds great. I guess the point I was just going to make is this is a belief that markets will be efficient. Well, maybe it'll happen when we're all dead, but they'll be efficient then.
No, it's deeper than that. It's deeper than that. They were efficient.
That they were efficient.
They were efficient.
That this was efficient.
Yes.
And that that's okay.
Yes.
Okay. So in other words, whatever the human consequences are insignificant as long as the market is efficient.
I'm not characterizing it. You need to read the paper and characterize it on your own.
Okay. All right. Well, that's...
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you both. I'm thrilled you're there. I will send you the Pavlov and Wachter, a few of those papers. I will send you this paper by the economists, which hopefully will give you some insight. And I do suggest you speak to Sarah.
I will. Alexis had one more question
Professor,
for you.
Can you
I want to also mention that knowledge at Wharton has kind of characterized my views over time. And they have a document. Let me put you on speakerphone for a moment where I can look for it.
Okay.
They have a document they put together, I think it was 2 years ago, which I haven't read most of this. And by the way, I haven't even read that paper that I'm referring to in the chapter, but I think it's and my editors have read it. So anyway, the global financial crisis and after. After 10th year anniversary of Knowledge Wharton. Knowledge at Wharton. And it it characterizes some of what I have said. I don't know if it's here, but someone pointed out that it's on the web that I said in 2005, it's actually on the web with the 2005 date, this is a turning point. And we will be lucky if housing prices hold as opposed to plummeting.
Are you saying this now? Or?
No, I said it in 2005 and on the web.
Okay, so you said this in 2005. Okay.
Correct.
All right.
All right, now you have one more question.
One more question if you have one quick minute, and that is for the tape, you know, at the end of this conversation, would you mind just summarizing really quickly your CV, you know, where you were educated, and just some quick highlights of your positions?
I am the Richard B. Worley Professor of Financial Management at the Wharton School, Professor of Real Estate and Finance at the Wharton School, Professor in the Real Estate Department and the Finance Department. I have been here since the 1970s. I helped to found the Real Estate Department as a separate department with hiring responsibilities to help develop analog real estate as a research field, and we've been exemplary, I believe, as an example for other universities and business schools as well to set up to institutionalize analytic real estate. I have published over 150, 200 papers. One of my first papers on constraints in housing markets is the best cited paper in the 25-year history of the Real Estate Economics Journal. I have been given the Lifetime Achievement Award by the Real Estate Economics Association. The president of the Real Estate Economics Association, which formal title is American Real Estate and Urban Economics Association. I've been an editor of the Real Estate Economics Journal. I've been on the editorial board of many journals. I have my undergraduate degree is in economics from Harvard. I have a PhD from Boston College, graduate school, and I have served on boards of directors in New York Stock Exchange, as well as have been honored to be Assistant Secretary for Policy Development and Research under President Clinton.
What were the years you were Assistant Secretary?
1998 to 2001.
Okay, great.
Well, and you're going to send us all these papers that you've done. Not 120,
yes,
not 150,
no,
please.
But
okay, that sounds great. And you think we should also talk? You're going to talk to Eric Belsky, you said, to get some more.
Yes, I will. That's right.
I love that scene. Yes. What's the best email?
water@wharton.upenn.edu.
We're supposed to hopefully interview at some point here former Secretary Cisneros and Andrew Cuomo. Do you have any thoughts about some questions we could ask them that might not occur to us that might be helpful?
Well, I think it would be very useful to interview Andrew Cuomo on the predatory lending.
Okay.
And what they saw then.
Okay.
Okay.
And why, you know, he pushed for this. He also pushed for, and this is a very interesting side story, for more clarity in transaction costs and brokerage fees, and this has to do with yield spread premium, all of that. And I think he's been mischaracterized in that set of issues. But you certainly should discuss his standing and where he was coming from. But in general, the secretaries of HUD have pushed to a man, Republican or Democrat, for more clarity in fees and transactions of mortgages. And only after this crisis has that been put into place. But that was a great push when Andrew was there, as well as subsequent secretaries, and not welcome by the industry. In fact, resisted. And one secretary, Jackson, I believe, was in fact only allowed to be confirmed once he said he wouldn't push for the transparency. So that's a whole line of discussion, which I think is tremendously important. You say you're interviewing Andrew Cuomo, and who's the other person?
Cisneros. We're going
Cisneros.
To talk to him.
Yes, Cisneros, way before his time, you know, issues of CRA and we haven't talked about this obviously, but affordable lending, CRA. How to do CRA lending well? Maybe you can actually push him on, because many people today, of course, see this as the culprit. I surely do not see this as a culprit, but you certainly should be speaking to people at Fannie and Freddie, if you haven't already done so. I'm thinking like Ed Golding, for example, like Barry Zegas, on their views as to Fannie and Freddie's part in this collapse.
A quick question about that. I had started to ask you about the GSEs. Do you see them as causal?
I certainly think they contributed starting in 2005 and 2006. I think in the critical years, 2003, 2004, and part of 2005, their market share was declining.
Right.
As was FHA. And they were being pushed, and, you know, you have, again, this is hearsay, Mozilla is being quoted in the New York Times, you take our subprime or I take it elsewhere, and your market share declines further, so take it or leave it. Nonetheless, they certainly are culpable in this, and so are the regulators. And a very interesting question about the regulators and who is pushing them to take on more Alt-A loans and subprime loans. Who was doing that in 2006, 2007 even, when the rest of the market was stepping out?
Who do you suspect?
I'd rather you pursue that.
All right.
Can you give us a hint? Can you give us a hint?
I'm sorry.
What if we turn off the tape? Can you tell us off the record?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to turn it off.